Hi, my name is Doug Phillips. Welcome to the April edition of the podcast for the American Journal of Neuroradiology. This April edition again covers papers chosen by the editors as items of interest in the upcoming edition of the American Journal of Neuroradiology. This April podcast will be accompanied in a few weeks by another podcast on brain tumor imaging. This corresponds to the release of a special edition of the American Journal of Neuroradiology on brain tumor imaging. I will be interviewing Dr. Soonmi Cha from the University of California, San Francisco, for her part in editing the special edition of the American Journal of Neuroradiology. Let's begin with the editor's choices for this month. The first paper by Srinivasan et al., entitled "The Utility of the K-Means Clustering Algorithm in Differentiating Apparent Diffusion Coefficient Values of Benign and Malignant Neck Pathologies." What is K-means clustering? K-means clustering is a statistical technique that allows one to cluster or to classify objects according to a common trait. I would strongly encourage reviewing the article for some of the statistics and the technique of this particular evaluation. In this study, the authors used that technique in an attempt to classify neck lesions into either benign or malignant categories according to their ADC values. The rationale for this statistical technique is simple. Using isolated ADC values for the same purpose is fraught with difficulty and not always reliable. The authors retrospectively assessed 10 benign and 10 malignant neck lesions and clustered them into a two-partition model, one with either low or high ADC values, or into a three-partition model, one with low, one with intermediate, and one with high ADC values. Their results? Statistically significant differences were found for benign versus malignant lesions in both partition models, either two or three partition, and were also relatively highly predictive of malignancy. They conclude that clustering of large data sets provides a better characterization of neck lesions when compared to whole lesion ADC alone. Whether or not this technique develops into a clinically valuable tool will obviously depend on a number of factors: the ease of use of K-means clustering, the appearance of other supporting evidence in the literature, and the overall reliability of the technique. It is still unclear how this technique will stand in the place of the obvious need for tissue characterization in many of these patients, typically through histology. Perhaps only malignant lesions will go on to tissue characterization, or indeed, perhaps further characterization of the lesions will prove possible. It is a very exciting development in the area of computer-assisted diagnoses. The next paper of editor's choices for review by Thee et al., a novel association between RASA1 mutations and spinal arteriovenous anomalies. This wonderful article is, according to the editors, destined to become a classic. The association of capillary vascular malformations and spinal AVMs and/or AVFs is newly recognized. They seem to be rather convincingly due to mutations in the RASA1 gene, which is located on the long arm of chromosome 5. This new syndrome is already named, referred to as CM-AVM. The RASA1 gene partly controls vascular cellular proliferation and differentiation. The authors found 5 patients with skin and spine metameric lesions and investigated them for the gene mutation, which all patients proved to harbor. This is the first report of this association, and the authors speculate that similar genetic abnormalities may be responsible for other metameric spinal and cerebral vascular conditions. Many points to this paper. We are obviously moving rapidly into an era of genetic typing of individuals, of common disease states, and of unusual or rare diseases. As more genetic mutations are proven responsible for more diseases, I think we can all expect to see more papers in a similar light covering additional conditions. Disease clusters are being aggressively studied by geneticists, and many other diseases are surely to be similarly linked to genetic abnormalities. This paper then is a harbinger of the future of disease and genetic linking. The next paper of the editor's choices by Kulsar et al., The Penumbra System, a novel mechanical thrombectomy device for large vessel occlusions in acute stroke. Although the Penumbra clot retrieval device is approved for intracranial use, the authors of this original investigation set out to evaluate if it can be used for recanalization of large, more proximal internal carotid artery occlusions. 27 patients in their series underwent isolated thrombectomy or thrombectomy in combination with pharmacological clot lysis as well as stent placement. The goals of treatment were improvement of the stenosis, improvement in NIHSS grade, and patient outcome. 23 of the 27 patients had anterior circulation occlusions, and the basilar artery was involved in an additional 4. Adequate recanalization was accomplished in 93% of patients, while over 50% of their patients showed clinical improvement at the time of discharge. Complete recanalization correlated with a favorable outcome, and the overall mortality of the series was 11%. The author's conclusion: the Penumbra system shows high potential for recanalization of large arteries. Mechanical thrombectomy for stroke intervention continues to be an invaluable addition to the armamentarium of stroke therapists. The devices are certainly improving both in efficacy and in safety, and we will certainly see more applications as well as, very likely, more devices. Now let's move to the fellow's choices for this month. Aguid et al., negative CT angiography findings in patients with spontaneous subarachnoid hemorrhage. When is digital subtraction angiography still needed? A very novel and very controversial paper. About 20% of patients, as we all know, who present with subarachnoid hemorrhage will show no demonstrable underlying cause by catheter angiography. Can CTA as a replacement or stand-in for digital subtraction angiography be used to exclude an underlying aneurysm instead of the need to resort to conventional angiography? The authors in this series retrospectively identified 193 patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage and negative CTA who also underwent catheter angiograms. They correlated the location of the subarachnoid hemorrhage with findings on CTA and DSA. In the acute setting, only one patient had an aneurysm not seen on CTA, while on repeat angiography, 4 such cases were subsequently identified. 5 patients had, however, complications from the DSA exam. A common cause of subarachnoid hemorrhage with a negative CTA was vasculitis. The authors conclude that initial negative CTA findings are reliable in ruling out aneurysms in patients with subarachnoid hemorrhage isolated to the perimesencephalic region, but the DSA continues to be needed in patients with initially negative CTA but diffuse subarachnoid hemorrhage. Vasculitis in this series, as I'm sure many of us have seen, was associated with a more peripheral subarachnoid hemorrhage pattern. It seems that the debate about the CTA-negative subarachnoid hemorrhage patient continues. Obviously, anecdotes abound, and there are numerous reported series of CTA versus catheter angiography in the patient with acute subarachnoid hemorrhage. Also, opinions widely vary and will likely continue to. This paper points out the high accuracy of CTA in the setting of acute subarachnoid hemorrhage when performed at a center with experienced readers utilizing state-of-the-art technique. Subarachnoid hemorrhage location proves to be an important factor in the ultimate utility of DSA in this series. Next paper under the Fellows Interest section by Furtado et al., Optimal Brain Perfusion CT Coverage in Patients with Acute Middle Cerebral Artery Stroke. More and more institutions rely on CT perfusion instead of MR perfusion due to its ease of access. The extent of brain coverage with some CT units is still limited. and the authors undertook this study to determine the amount of coverage needed to estimate the size of MCA infarctions and the core penumbra mismatch. 50 acute stroke patients in this series underwent CT perfusion with 16 by 5 millimeter slices, and the overall accuracy and impact on patient management were studied. All of these patients had follow-up studies 3 days to 3 months later. The authors concluded that to determine mismatch and to select patients for treatment, coverage of 75 millimeters is needed, and at least 50 millimeters of coverage is needed to assess core infarcts. Thus, those older CT units that give you only 3 perfusion slices may not be the best choice in imaging. It is unlikely that many sites are still utilizing many of these systems, but for those that do, the technique appears to be flawed from the outset. The debate for CT perfusion continues. Many of us are still involved in discussions of radiation exposure with these studies, and it seems that the debate will continue in one form or the other for the foreseeable future. It does continue to be a very useful technique in the evaluation of the acute stroke patient. Next paper in the fellows section and the last paper for this month by Gaughan et al. Utility of CT angiography in the identification and characterization of supraclinoid internal carotid artery blister aneurysms. How can those folks from UVA see so many blood blister-like aneurysms when many of us almost never see one? UVA, of course, is my prior institution, so I have a bit of a warm spot in my heart for that place. Blister aneurysms are indeed a complicated entity. These aneurysms, seemingly more prevalent on the anterior and lateral surface of the supraclinoid internal carotid artery, are characterized by their very wide necks and ultra-thin domes. These aneurysms are very difficult to manage. Surgeons find the lesions nearly impossible to clip, and the interventional therapy that has been utilized has been somewhat disappointing. Stenting may be required in many of these lesions. These aneurysms are very rare, but when they bleed, the resulting morbidity and mortality are very high. They are difficult to diagnose even with DSA. But these authors evaluated the utility of CTA in their identification and characterization. In a 12-month period, they found 6 such patients who underwent both CTA and DSA. All of the patients had subarachnoid hemorrhage, and all aneurysms were seen on digital subtraction angiography, serving as the gold standard in this study, while only 4 were initially seen on CTA. Therefore, the authors concluded that if CTA is negative, DSA is still needed to exclude this rare type of aneurysm. While, as stated, CTA is disappointing in this review, it's important to note that the majority of the lesions are still depicted by CTA. Again, we come to the debate as to the place of CTA in the evaluation of subarachnoid hemorrhage patients. A knowledge of the appearance and typical location for these aneurysms may make better observers of us all and increase our yield in finding these rare aneurysms.
We're speaking with Dr. John Gaughan, instructor in the Division of Interventional Neuroradiology, Department of Radiology at the University of Virginia Health Systems. John, a very nice paper chosen for the podcast this month on blister aneurysms. Unusual topic and something that you all seem to see a lot of. Why don't you give us a couple minutes on the significance of blister aneurysms, what they look like, why they're referred to as blister aneurysms, and any other details you'd care to provide.
All right. Well, thank you, Dr. Phillips. Thank you for having me on. We have in recent years seen a fair number of blister aneurysms. Blister aneurysms are an uncommon but potentially catastrophic cause of subarachnoid hemorrhage. They represent a strong minority of aneurysms, ranging from maybe 1 to 5% of ruptured aneurysms, but they probably have a different histopathology or pathophysiology from true saccular aneurysms in that they're probably more related to dissections and pseudoaneurysms, and as such, they have a very precipitous course and can lead to catastrophic problems. In the past 2 years, I've seen probably a little bit more than that. In our paper, we looked at probably about 200 aneurysms that had come in that were ruptured aneurysms, and I think about 6% of them turned out to be ruptured blister aneurysm. So it's a disease that is relatively uncommon, but one that's very important to identify. Having a strong index of suspicion and working knowledge of the disease process is very important for identifying these, because they can be very subtle on imaging sequences, particularly CTA, but also on subtraction angiography, and they resemble very shallow outpouchings and non-branch points of the supraclinal ICA. You can also have blister aneurysms in other blood vessels. Our paper specifically looks at supraclinoid ICA blister aneurysms. But they can be difficult to see, but they grow rapidly and bleed commonly. And so I think a strong index of suspicion and a working knowledge of the disease is very important for identifying them.
Your numbers are certainly quite impressive, and I think something to take away is that CTA still does a reasonable job of finding blister aneurysms if you have a high index of suspicion. I notice you all still call DSA the gold standard examination, but I know in talking to you that some of these cases were actually missed on prior digital subtraction angiographic studies, so I guess it's that whole idea of a gold standard. What really does the gold standard represent? Could you comment on some of those aneurysms that you all saw in follow-up?
Sure. I think we still consider DSA the gold standard because, particularly for this disease entity and many of the cerebrovascular disease entities, we still consider the gold standard because it does the best at diagnosing these disease processes, but it's certainly not 100% specific or sensitive for detecting even blister aneurysms or other aneurysms. There are a lot of things that can confound the interpretation of a DSA or CTA in looking at aneurysms, and that's one of the reasons that patients that have negative DSA imaging at initial presentation with subarachnoid hemorrhage often undergo repeat imaging to try to find subtle abnormalities that may have been missed initially. I think the biggest problem with blister aneurysms is that even in their most pronounced form or very shallow, are often only seen in one projection on DSA imaging and lay down along the level of resolution on CTA. So I think DSA imaging is the gold standard still, but even within DSA imaging, I think you have to have a very strong index of suspicion and really scrutinize the supraclinoid ICAs to see these aneurysms. In our series, I'm not sure that any were missed on DSA imaging, although some of them were so subtle that they were difficult to diagnose with certainty. But we have certainly seen aneurysms that have been transferred to our institution from other places that had DSA imaging and blister aneurysms that were interpreted as negative, that when you really scrutinize the images, the aneurysms were visible. So, again, I think it's very important to understand where these aneurysms are and what they look like in order to be able to make their diagnosis.
Any points that you could bring out regarding the patient presentation or anything on imaging studies that should clue someone interpreting these studies into the potential presence or diagnosis of blister aneurysm? Or do you think it's just always have that high index of suspicion?
Well, I think there are cases where you see bleeding. You know, these are pseudoaneurysms, so they're high-pressure aneurysmal pattern bleeding. So it's very common to see large subarachnoid aneurysmal patterns of subarachnoid hemorrhage. So I think a high index of suspicion is necessary.
So you mean a large volume of hemorrhage overall?
Yeah, they're usually pretty pronounced bleeding patterns. So when you do an angiogram or you do a CTA and you see this pattern of bleeding and you don't see an aneurysm, I'm really concerned that there's some subtle abnormality that we're missing that's something that needs to not be missed. But the understanding where they are and what they look like, we routinely do CTA for subarachnoid hemorrhage sort of as our first measure of triage. And this paper, to me, pointed out that you can't really rely completely on CTA for diagnosing this entity. So it's one of the entities that you can go into a digital subtraction angiogram not having a suspicion for and ended up finding. So I think that this index of suspicion is a very important part of making that diagnosis. There's no pattern to the bleed. There's no distribution of blood or amount of blood that really makes you think of blister aneurysm over any other aneurysm. It's just usually they have a degree of bleeding that you would expect to see an abnormality relatively easily, and you don't. And it really leaves you concerned that there's something there that you need to find.
So you say that CTA still is a routine initial diagnostic examination for subarachnoid hemorrhages at the University of Virginia?
It is.
And are you all happy with your results with CTA? And you know that has certainly been a point of some debate in the literature, whether or not the CTAs are serving useful purpose in the triage of those patients or whether it's just delaying the patient arriving at diagnostic angiography?
Well, I've had several conversations in the recent past on this subject, and I personally feel very strongly that CTA imaging is a good triage in the workup of subarachnoid hemorrhage, mainly because in the majority of these cases, you find the abnormality that has caused the problem, and you're able to identify that, and that cuts down on DSA imaging time, procedure time, and CTA, other than renal issues in contrast, puts the patient at no risk, whereas patients that have had subarachnoid hemorrhage are in a hypercoagulable state, and so DSA imaging, even if you're just doing diagnostic imaging, the patient is at somewhat higher risk of thromboembolic complications from that procedure. So being able to cut down on the amount of time and amount of vessels that you interrogate during DSA imaging, I think, is important. And there are still cases that are negative on CTA that we end up doing DSA imaging on, but I think that we're able to tailor our procedures to cut down on procedural time, radiation dose, contrast dose. And there are some patients that get triaged immediately to surgery based on CTA. In our program, I think it does help reduce the risk to the patient. And I don't think that it slows down the workup and the treatment of these patients, because the vast majority of these patients that come in after the regular working hours end up getting treated the next morning anyway.
Maybe you could explain for everyone listening why these aneurysms are so difficult to manage, why the outcomes are not all that good, despite eventually being able to make a diagnosis.
Right. Well, as this paper points out, diagnosis with CTA is probably less than optimal. DSA does a better job at this point in diagnosing these aneurysms, and some of that relates to how the small size of these aneurysms and imaging techniques with CT versus DSA. But these aneurysms are also very difficult to treat, and we actually have another article that's going to be published in the AJNR that talks about the treatment of these entities. And the main problem is that they're not true aneurysms, so they have a very thin, friable wall that surgeons say when they go in to try to clip are basically tissue paper, and have a very difficult time controlling bleeding and securing the aneurysm without ripping the walls and making surgical outcomes pretty poor. So if you look at the standard surgical data for this disease, it's pretty poor with a very high morbidity and mortality. So there are a lot of novel treatments that have been entertained both surgically and endovascularly to try to treat these aneurysms a little bit more effectively. And unfortunately, some of the standard endovascular and surgical techniques are not completely effective because you're treating basically a contained rupture rather than a true aneurysm sac.
Your paper that's upcoming, I understand you all have had some experience with stenting these aneurysms?
We have, and we've used endovascular stents as part of a planned stent-assisted coiling procedure, but many of these aneurysms are too small, even with a stent in place, to safely put a coil in. They carry dimensions of, a lot of times, depths of less than 2 or even less than 1 millimeter. So they can be very shallow aneurysms that can be difficult or possible to put coils in. So we've had several instances in the past couple years in which we've used stenting alone using an overlapping stent technique or a telescoping stent technique to try to reduce the flow or divert the flow from the aneurysm in an attempt to help the aneurysm seal off. We've used coils in a couple of them to augment that and have had very good results in the small cohort of patients that we've been able to use this on. So I think the ultimate treatment for these would be some of the stuff that they're looking at right now for the future, flow-diverting small-celled stents like the pipeline stent system. I think something like that would be ideal for these, because basically what you want to do is you want to divert the flow because the aneurysm sac isn't really large enough to treat itself.
Speaking with us on a very important entity for those of us doing non-invasive CTA imaging or those performing angiography, blister aneurysms of the supraclavian internal carotid artery, Dr. John Gaughan from the University of Virginia. John, I'd like to thank you very much for your time.
Hi, Phil. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for listening. This has been the April podcast from the American Journal of Neuroradiology. I'm Doug Phillips, and thanks for tuning in.